schooling had gone by the wayside for working on neighboring farms. Mike would rather have been in class, and Frankie needed more teaching. He could barely read. Mike paced in the stairwell until he heard the whistle that meant Frankie was safely on the ground. He hurried to the window and watched him dash across the walkway and knock on a ground floor window. It opened, and James helped Frankie inside. Mike shook his head, amazed. The kid already had more friends here than he could count. Mike couldn't claim one. That was fine by him. None of the uppers ever bothered him because of his size, but they didn't include him either. He couldn't blame them. He wasn't good at sports, kept to himself, and as much as he tried, he couldn't help his seriousness. He'd promised Granny he'd look out for Frankie and take care of him. That responsibility had become another layer of skin. Just when he thought he might shed a little or breathe easy or even laugh out loud, it tightened over him. In every situation, Mike wondered first, what could go wrong, and second, how he would protect Frankie if it did. Mike quietly crept back into his dorm room. Mouse was sprawled across the space next to him. He was older and taller than Mike and didn't fit well on the cot. Mike carefully stepped around him and climbed onto his own thin mattress. In the gray light, he lay back and stared at the wrinkles of old paint on the ceiling. Maybe the people coming tomorrow would be the answer to getting out of this place. Maybe they even had a piano. Mike rubbed his forehead, much as it pained him to imagine it. He'd forego the piano if they were decent folks and he and Frankie could stay together. Then again, what if he and Frankie were fostered out to someone mean to the bone? There was always so much that could go wrong. Chapter 2. Pennyweather sent for them on Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Mike and Frankie waited in the visitation room connected to her office. The draperies had been pulled open wide, so the sunlight streamed in, making everything look bright and cheerful. Centered in the room was a long table with benches on either side. A bowl of shiny apples and a vase of flowers had been positioned just so. Pennyweather always liked to put on a good show. The office door was open and Mike could hear her talking on the phone.
"Musical instruments? Yes, we have a piano. There are several boys here who could... Of course I'd consider... Yes, you could hear it played. It's an upright. Very good quality. That would be fine. A week from today at 1 o'clock. And if you like what you hear, you can arrange to take... Yes. Goodbye."
Mike winced. Pennyweather was selling the piano? The broken-down upright in the dining hall was out of tune from years of boys pounding on it. One of the pedals was broken. Even so, it was still playable. His first day at Bishop's, Mike had wolfed his food at every meal and then scooted over to play. Pennyweather quickly put an end to that, saying she didn't need more noise during meals with the dishes rattling and all the boys yapping. Mike had found a way around it. After the boys were excused from dinner, Pennyweather left. He hung back to scrape food off the plates and stack them for the cooks and whoever was on dish duty. If he was fast about it, he had a half hour or more at the keyboard before he had to be back in the dorm. Sometimes, Frankie stayed and played duets with him. At first, the boys in the kitchen threw bread scraps at them, until they heard Mike's and Frankie's talent. Now, they made requests. Even in the piano's sorry condition, Mike hated to see it go. Then again, if they were fostered out, it wouldn't make any difference. Pennyweather walked into the visitation room. Frankie ran to Mike and clung to his arm. She stood in front of them in her navy blue high-necked dress, looking pinched. Her gray hair had been pulled so tight into a topknot that her eyes squinted. Mike wondered if it hurt.
"Stand straight and don't fidget," she said. "Mr. and Mrs. Rutledge will be in here shortly. They're the last appointment of the day. Don't speak unless you're spoken to, and try to look pleasant. They want two boys, which, as you know, doesn't happen very often."
Mike's heart pounded. They wanted two? He looked at Frankie, who smiled up at him. Mike wiped a smudge from Frankie's cheek. The kid's pants were torn and he had no socks. Mike's shirt was stained and threadbare. The clothes Granny had sent with them, that she'd washed and pressed and carefully folded, had disappeared into the general laundry at Bishop's, which left everything the same dingy gray.
"Do I look all right?" asked Frankie. "Mouse told me the more raggedy you look, the more likely you are to be fostered because people feel sorry," whispered Mike.
If that was the case, he and Frankie were on their way out of Bishop's. The door opened, and a couple stepped into the room. The man wore coveralls and a blue work shirt. He held a wide-brimmed hat in his hand. Farmers. But Mike wouldn't mind the labor as long as they were kind. The woman, her hands in white gloves and a pocketbook in the crook of her arm, fidgeted with the buttons on her calico shirtwaist.
"Mr. and Mrs. Rutledge," said Pennyweather, smiling, "welcome to the Bishop's home for—"
"Them the boys?" interrupted the man.
"Yes, Michael and Franklin Flannery."
"I know I mentioned I needed two, but I stopped at the state home on the way here and got me a couple strapping boys can work a farm. Grown men want a paycheck, and all I got to offer is room and board. Hard times, you know. Still, Mother here has her heart set on a youngster for the house. So I agreed."
The woman stepped forward.
"Feeding the chickens, pulling weeds, fetch and carry."
The man walked over to Frankie and squished his upper arm as if to check his muscle.
"He seems kind of puny."
Frankie jerked away.
"Oh, I assure you, Mr. Rutledge, he's stronger than he looks," said Pennyweather. "And if you would like another the same age as Franklin, you can have both for the same arrangement we discussed on the phone earlier."
"Now, that's a deal. That okay with you, Mother?"
The woman shrugged.
"Sometimes two is easier than one. Just like puppies."
Mike's heart pounded. They were going to take two lowers, and not him? He put an arm around Frankie.
"We're brothers. We stay together."
The man rubbed his chin and studied Mike.
"You got any special skills? Roofing? Fencing? Driving a tractor?"
Mike stammered.
I play the piano."
"That doesn't do me no good. Nah, I already got me the two plowboys. Just the younger boys will do."
Pennyweather walked toward Mike and glared.
"This is a good opportunity for Franklin—"
"No!"
screamed Frankie, hugging Mike's leg.
"There now," said the man. "We'll have none of that."
He reached out and grabbed Frankie's arm. Mike shoved the man.
"Leave my brother alone."
Mr. Rutledge stumbled backward.
"Now, just a minute here. You keep your hands to yourself."
Frankie lunged toward the man, grabbed his hand, pulled it to his mouth, and bit.
"Ah!"
he yelled. Pennyweather reached for Frankie and missed.
"Franklin!"
He darted behind Mike.
"He's bleeding!" cried the woman.
Blood dots beaded up on the man's hand. He pulled a handkerchief from his pocket and bandaged it. Frankie scrambled into Mike's arms, wrapping his legs around him and burying his face in his neck.
"It's no use, mister,"
said Mike, hugging Frankie to him.
"First chance, he'll run away. He's no good to you without me."
"In all my days, I'd never seen such a thing," said the man.
He turned to Pennyweather.
"What are you raising here, animals? Come on, Mother."
He held the door for his wife, gave the boys a disgusted look, and slammed the door behind him. Mike put Frankie down and looked at Pennyweather. Her face was anger-stricken. Her eyebrows nearly touched her hairline. She marched across the room, opened the door, and pointed to Frankie.
"Wait outside!"
After slamming the door, she whipped around to confront Mike. He felt his face grow warm and knew it would be pink and splotchy in seconds. At the slightest feelings of embarrassment or blame or anger, he lit up like a thermometer sensing a high fever. Granny had always said it was a consequence of being red-haired and fair-skinned.
"Your brother has been called up twice since you've been here. The first time he spat on a woman's baby, and now this? There are places much worse than Bishop's for wild boys like him."
Mike talked fast.
He didn't mean it. He only acts out because he wants to stay with me. He gets along good with all the other boys. As long as we're together, he's just fine.
Pennyweather crossed her arms.
It's hard enough to get people to take one child, let alone two.
Mike stood as tall as he could, his eyes pleading.
You promised our grandmother.
I promised her I'd try to keep you together. It was by no means binding.
Pennyweather's anger stayed in her eyes, but her face changed and she smiled.
It won't make a bit of difference soon. Hathaway House in Montgomery County is filled to overflowing with boys over 14. They are making it worth my while to create room for them here. Any of the lowers left by September will go to the state home to free up beds for the Hathaway boys.
Mike felt as if someone had jerked a rug out from under him, and he might topple at any minute. He steadied himself on the table.
Then I'll go with Frankie.
Not if I put you out to hire.
It's not legal till I'm 14. I'm not even 12 for another 6 months.
Pennyweather shook her head.
Who's going to believe you're not 14, tall as you are? All I have to say is you came with no birth certificate. It happens all the time. You could be on a farm 50 miles away in another county. You better hope a family comes along for Franklin before September, and he behaves enough for them to want him, or he'll be in the state home, and you'll be working who knows where. You two can mull that over long and hard in the cellar.
Since the day they'd arrived, Mike had worried about what might happen if he and Frankie were separated. It was a dark cloud on the horizon of his mind, always looming, always menacing. He'd thought he had time to figure things out. Now, instead of 2.5 years away, the storm was overhead.
Chapter 3. The cellar was a large dungeon-like room below the kitchen. At one time, the walls had been whitewashed, but the paint was spotty and the old bricks showed through. Above, a ground-level window let in a shaft of light. Cupboards lined the back. A narrow wooden table sat in the center of the room, its benches pushed against a side wall.
At least it's cool down here,
said Frankie. Mike sat on a bench and leaned against the bricks. Frankie sat next to him.
Sorry I bit him,
Mike tousled his hair.
I'm not.
Frankie stared at the padlocked cupboards.
What do you think's inside?
Probably everything she ever took from a boy, said Mike.
Like the harmonicas Granny gave us?
Like the harmonicas, said Mike.
The first day they arrived, Pennyweather had confiscated them, saying if she let every boy have one, she'd be batty from all the noise. She dropped them into a box, never to be seen again. Frankie lay down on the bench, put his hands behind his head, and stared at the ceiling.
Tell me this story again.
Mike didn't have to ask which one. There was only one story Frankie ever wanted.
It's your turn to tell, said Mike, knowing full well that Frankie would do most of the talking anyway.
Okay,
said Frankie.
Our dad and mom lived in a town with a lumber mill.
Allentown, said Mike.
I'm telling, remember?
Said Frankie.
Allentown. When I was just a tiny baby, there was an accident at the mill and our dad died. Our mom brought us to Granny's 'cause we didn't have any money, and the lords were going to turn us out on the street.
Landlords, said Mike.
Yeah. So our mom got a job at the diner, and we all lived together at Granny's, and it was crowded.
And where was that? Asked Mike.
Philly. That's what the lads call Philadelphia for short. Philly.
Mike nodded, remembering Granny's tiny third-floor apartment with its hand-printed sign propped in her front window. Piano lessons. The upright was in the parlor, and while she taught, Mike had to stay in the bedroom and entertain Frankie. When it was warm enough and Frankie was napping, Mike took to the stoop outside where he played the harmonica. Even then, he could copy any song he heard on the radio.
And our mom sang to us,
said Frankie.
Every night, twinkle, twinkle, little star, hush, little baby,
Are you sleeping? Then, our mom started getting sick with sumption.
Consumption, said Mike.
Yeah, and she coughed all the time and got skinny, and one day she went to the hospital, and even the doctors couldn't fix her. It was sad, except I don't remember because I was only two. But you remember, 'cause you were six.
Yes, I do, whispered Mike.
Granny had been giving a piano lesson to Mary Beth Flanagan from across the hall. When Mary Beth finished her piece, America the Beautiful, Granny shook her head and said,
Mary Beth, I'd jump for joy if you'd learn that piece proper and put a little of your heart and soul into it. Practice this week and come back and make me proud.
At that moment, his mother walked in from work at the diner, looked from Granny to Mary Beth Flanagan, to Mike, and fainted. When she came to, Granny ran to get help. Then she took Mama to the hospital while Mrs. Flanagan sat with Mike and Frankie. Only Granny came home. Day after day, Mike had stood at the front window, watching for his mother. Granny would gently pull him away, but he'd wander back, like a homing pigeon rooted to one post. It seemed there'd been no minutes or hours, just one long day of searching out that window and waiting. One long day that lasted 2 weeks, until Granny told him his mother hadn't been strong enough for this world. What other world was there? And where was it? After that, Granny tried to interest him in storybooks and games, but nothing worked until she sat him next to her at the piano. As she taught lesson after lesson, Mike stayed at her side, his new perch, watching other children's fingers on the keys and listening to the metronome tick. One day, between students, Granny had left him sitting on the piano bench. He reached out toward the keyboard, placing his fingers as he'd seen the others do, and pressed. But instead of a harmonious chord, it was a jarring and painful sound, as if his sadness had traveled from his fingers onto the keys, and the sounds repeated the awfulness he felt inside. With his fingers wide, he pounded on the keys over and over as the room filled with his grief. When Granny came back into the room and saw his wrenched face and his wild hands hammering away, she sank into a chair, all the while crying herself. That evening, she started teaching him proper. Each time he learned a song, it seemed that it mirrored his sorrow and anger and love. Granny said he had a God-given gift for music. Secretly, he thought his mother must have sent the gift so that she could hear him playing from the other world. Sometimes he even imagined her humming along.
Mike, are you listening?
Frankie sat up on the bench in the cellar and shook his arm.
Yeah, I'm listening. Granny took care of us and loved us.
Yes, she did, said Mike. We didn't have a lot, but we always had her.
Things had been difficult the last few years they'd lived with Granny. So many people were out of work. Piano lessons became a luxury few could afford. Granny's students dwindled to a small handful, and even those families often paid with food or a used jacket for Mike or Frankie instead of money. Most months, Granny just squeaked by with the rent. Even so, weather permitting, every Sunday afternoon she threw open her front window and she and Mike took turns playing the piano for the entire neighborhood. Brahms, Chopin, Mozart, Debussy. She said people on hard times deserve to have beauty in their lives as much as anyone else, whether or not they could pay their rent or were walking to a bread line. Granny said that just because someone was poor didn't mean they were poor of heart.
Then, when Granny got too old and delicate to take care of us anymore, she brought us to Bishop's, 'cause it was the only place with a piano, said Frankie.
Mike closed his eyes. He could still see Granny standing in Pennyweather's office with a nurse at her side. Withered and trembling, she had hugged them one last time. Her voice had wavered.
be my sweet boys and promise to take care of each other. The right person will come and want two fine boys. I know it in my soul."
The cellar seemed to close in on Mike. "That's right, Frankie," he said, pushing tears from his cheek.
"She chose Bishop's because it had a piano.
And then Granny went to the old folks' home, and she died,"
said Frankie.
"I miss her."
Mike put his arm around him.
"And that's the end of the story,"
whispered Frankie.
"Nah, it's not the end," said Mike. "There's more. Remember? Someday, we'll get away from Bishop's and go to... Come on, you're telling the story."
"New York City,"
said Frankie, waving his arm in an arc.
"The Big Apple. Granny went there to visit and loved it."
"We're going to live there," said Mike. "It's going to be our city.
We're going to take the train and get all fancied up and go to a concert at Carnegie Hall, just like Granny did,"
said Frankie.
"That's right," said Mike.
"She always wanted to take us there."
"There will be a big, shiny black piano, right?"
said Frankie.
"And a famous piano player and an orchestra."
"Right," said Mike.
"The theater will be full, even the top balconies. Granny said the balconies are golden and the seats are red.
And all the musicians are dressed in black. And at the end..."
"Let me say it,"
said Frankie.
"We will stand up and clap and yell, Bravo! Bravo!"
Mike nodded. He didn't tell Frankie that when he imagined the scene at Carnegie Hall, he didn't see himself in one of those plush red seats. He saw himself on stage in a black tuxedo, standing next to the piano and bowing to the audience.
"And after the concert, you and me will go to dinner at a restaurant and order roasted beef and ice cream. It won't be like here, right, Mike?"
Mike looked down at Frankie in his tattered clothes. He could hear the kid's stomach grumbling for dinner.
"No, I promise. It won't be like here."
Chapter 4. Dinner was long over when Pennyweather let them out of the cellar and sent Mike and Frankie to their dormitories. Most of the boys on Mike's floor were huddled around the radio listening to Buck Rogers in the 25th Century. They must have behaved at dinner for Mrs. Godfrey to give them the privilege. Mike flopped down on his cot. Mouse, who was reading the funnies in a weeks-old newspaper, sat up, pulled two apples and a hunk of bread from behind his pillow, and held them out.
"You only missed creamed chicken, otherwise known as mystery gravy. I smuggled Frankie some food with his buddies. The little lads thought it was the most important mission of their lives."
"Hey, thanks," said Mike, taking the food and biting into an apple.
Mouse was almost 16 and one of the oldest at Bishop's. Most of the boys didn't like him because he was Pennyweather's pet, but Mike thought him decent enough. His name was Stephen, though no one ever called him that. With his milky skin, pale eyes, and white hair buzzed so close to his head that pink scalp showed through, Mouse couldn't complain one bit about his nickname.
"Danny Moriarty was in the nurse's office next to the visitation room today," said Mouse. "He heard what happened."
"You really punch a guy? And did Frankie bite him and draw blood?"
Mike nodded.
"My punch was more of a push, but Frankie left a set of teeth marks."
"Heard Pennyweather's going to put you out to hire."
"I'm not even close to 14,
said Mike. Mouse shrugged.
"Wise up. Bishop's is a work mill. You ain't been around this time of year before, but you'll see. Farmers are here first thing every morning, taking us older boys for day work. If their farm is far away, they take us for weeks, then bring us back when the plowing or picking or stacking is finished. Our measly stipend goes to Pennyweather for clothes and school supplies. You see any clothes or school supplies?"
"Why doesn't someone tell?"
"Ain't no one to tell," said Mouse. "Old man Bishop owns this place, but lives in the city. Heard the cooks talking about how Pennyweather only has to deliver a certain amount of money to him each month to keep him happy. She pockets the rest. None of them dare say a word with so many of their husbands skint and out of work. Can't afford to lose their jobs. Did Pennyweather really say she's getting rid of all the lowers and filling Bishops with Hathaway boys? Mike nodded. Uppers bring in the money. Lowers take up space. She's all business.
Mouse chewed on his lip and nodded.
That's gonna make things difficult for me. I won't be one of the oldest anymore. Might be time.
Mike frowned.
I thought you had it good. Aren't you Pennyweather's...
He caught himself and closed his mouth.
Pet? I admit it. I'm as nice as pie to Pennyweather, so she gives me privileges. What's wrong with that? Speaking of which, tomorrow morning I'm taking the wagon to make a delivery to Four Corners because the truck broke down. She told me to get someone to go with me. Want to come? Be back by noon. Beats working for Otis pulling weeds and rocks from his fields. One of the boys can let Frankie know.
Mike studied the apple core. He hadn't been away from Bishop since the day they'd arrived. Plus, boys were never fostered out on weekends, so Frankie wouldn't be called up. And the kid liked working at Otis's because at the end of the day, Mr. Otis pressed a penny into each boy's hand. Mike nodded.
Yeah, I'll go.
Before dawn, Mike and Mouse rode in the flatbed wagon down the long road leading away from Bishop's. On either side, cornfields walled in their view of everything but the green stalks and the gray sky. The air was cool, the horses clip-clopping hypnotic. For a while, neither boy spoke. The morning brightened. When the fields stopped, the world opened up on vast pastures.
"Sure is pretty,"
said Mouse, nudging Mike with his elbow.
"Anything is prettier than Bishop's."
Mike nodded toward the back of the wagon bed. He and Mouse had carefully stacked a dozen boxes on top of an old quilt to pad the ride.
"What's inside, anyway?"
"Supposed to be a secret, but one time I came down to the cellar before Pennyweather had finished packing. The cupboards were open and filled to choking with canned peaches, plums, jams, you name it. Jars had labels on them that said Methodist Women's Auxiliary. You know those church ladies who show up at Bishop's every month?"
"The smiley ones with the covered baskets?"
said Mike. Mouse nodded.
"They make pints of preserves for us poor orphans. Pennyweather changes the labels, sells them, and pockets the money. One day, I noticed a jar was missing the sealing ring, so I asked if I could have it, told her it wouldn't sell anyway, and how I loved peaches, and that I always heard she was fair-minded. She let me eat the whole thing."
"So, Pennyweather has a heart."
Mouse nodded.
"Everybody has a heart. Sometimes you gotta work hard to find it. One thing I learned is that if there's something you want or need to know from grown folks, you gotta step up and ask for it mannerly. Plead your case. That's what I say. More times than not, you'll get exactly what you asked for. You know the saying, you catch more flies with honey than with vinegar?"
If Granny had said it once, she'd said it 1,000 times.
"Means you get more by being nice and polite than being otherwise."
"That's right. Made my time at Bishop's more bearable, that's for sure. What do you want to do once you're out of there?"
Mike frowned.
"I can't think past getting Frankie settled."
"You tell Frankie what Pennyweather's up to?"
Mike shook his head.
"Didn't have it in me."
"Listen," said Mouse, "you gotta keep Frankie out of the state home. Ain't fit for a river rat. Kids have lice and fleas. Last year it was quarantined 'cause two boys died from a fever. Dead. Makes Bishop's look like the Biltmore Hotel. Next time he gets called up, you gotta make sure he goes. Pennyweather has to let you know where he is. It's a law. You can write him. Heard they even let brothers visit on holidays. Face it, you're confined to Bishop's till you're 18, but Frankie might have a chance to get out. Make a plan. You gotta have a plan."
They passed a sign that said, 4 Corners, 2 miles.
Before the intersection of two lanes, Mouse stopped the horse and handed Mike the reins.
"Here's where I get off. I'm going on the lam."
"What? You're running away?"
Mike's thoughts raced.
"Hey, I don't want any trouble at Bishop's." "Relax. Deliver the boxes to Four Corners. Get the money and take it to Pennyweather. Tell her I took off and you couldn't stop me. She'll report me, but I'll be long gone before a truant officer can catch up. Besides, all she cares about is someone bringing back the dough."
He jumped down from the seat.
"But where will you go? What will you do?"
"Don't worry. Got a plan. When I turn 18, I got two choices. The U.S. Army or the Tree Army."
"The what?"
"Civilian Conservation Corps. Lads call it the Tree Army. It's part of the President's New Deal to get the country out of the sad slump we're in. It's jobs for young men like yours truly. I can work any number of places, planting trees, stocking rivers with fish, building parks. Get paid $35 a month, too. I figure I'll do that for a year or so until I've seen some of the U.S. of A. Then, I'll join the military and see the world. Know a guy in the Marines told me there's always a war to fight somewhere in the world."
"What are you going to do until you turn 18?
"I'm almost 17. I can get by for a year. I got a friend who works at the train station in Philly, can sneak me on without a ticket. Heading to New York City. I'll live on the streets. Done it before. I know the safe places to sleep, the soup kitchens. Even know how to sneak into Yankee games and theaters."
Mouse grinned. Mike felt a tug at his heart. New York City. That was supposed to be his plan, too. His and Frankie's. Mouse climbed into the wagon bed and moved the boxes aside until he'd pulled the quilt from beneath them. He folded it like a jelly roll, tucked it under his arm, and jumped down.
"If you get Frankie sorted out and want to join me, my friend at the station is McAllister. Tell him I sent you. He'll get you on a train and tell you my usual whereabouts."
Without looking back, Mouse walked away, whistling. Mike sat in the wagon, watching him saunter down the road. He tried to imagine what it felt like to have no worries, to have nothing but a bedroll to carry, and the wide world in front of you. There was something exciting about the idea of taking a train to the big city, sleeping who knows where, and sneaking into a theater. Mike would go with Mouse, if it weren't for Frankie. On his own, he could make do with little. It would be so easy. Guilt squirmed into his thoughts.
"Be my sweet boys, and promise to take care of each other."
How could he even think of leaving Frankie? The kid loved Mike, and Mike loved him. Mike shook his head, disgusted with himself. What kind of brother was he? Mouse disappeared over a rise in the road. Mike flicked the reins, and the horse walked forward. Mouse was right. There was always a war somewhere in the world, and Mike had his own, fighting for Frankie. He made the delivery to Four Corners, collected the money, and drove back to Bishop's. The entire way, he felt like a wild bird trapped in a house, swooping up and down and into walls, wings flapping against windows, trying to find a way out.
Chapter 5.
On Monday morning, Mike was startled from a nightmare about lice and fevers and fleas. He bolted upright in his cot, his heart pounding. Before he could lie back down, he heard Frankie's whistle. It could only mean one thing. As Mike scrambled from his cot, he heard Mouse's warning again. "You gotta keep Frankie out of the state home. You gotta have a plan." If the kid was called up, how would Mike convince him he had to go? By the time Mike reached the stairwell and opened the window, Frankie was already waiting on the tree limb to be let in. Mike helped him inside, put his hands on Frankie's shoulders, and said, "Whatever happens, I'll figure out something. I promise, okay?" Frankie shrugged.
"Okay. Look."
He reached into his waistband and pulled out a folded newspaper page. He dropped cross-legged onto the floor, opened it up, and smoothed the paper out flat. The headline ran across both pages. "Huxley's Harmonica Wizards.
It's the biggest harmonica band you've ever seen. 60 boys. Mrs. Delancey read the article to us and let us listen on the radio last night. When she put the paper in the bin, I snuck back and took this page before anyone else could. Mike, there's nothing like 'em anywhere. You'd swear by the sound it was every kind of instrument and not just harmonicas.
Mike sank to the floor and leaned against the wall, blowing out a long breath. He nodded toward the newspaper.
Frankie, that is the emergency? Remember we talked about using the signal only when it was very, very important? Mike, look at them, said Frankie, tapping a photo that took up half a page. Before he died, John Philip Sousa wrote him a special song called The Harmonica Wizard March, and once he even directed the band in a concert. They've played in parades, and for 3 presidents.
Frankie held up his fingers and ticked them off.
Coolidge, Hoover, and our very own Happy Days Are Here Again, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They even played for a queen, and that's no lie. Now people call them the Harmonica Wizards and...
Take a breath, Frankie. You sound just like a radio announcer. Frankie looked down and chewed on his lip.
See, I can buy the official band harmonica if I have 65 cents, but I only saved up 23.
Mike couldn't help but smile. Frankie, last month you listened to a radio commercial for Wheaties and wanted the Lou Gehrig baseball card from the back of the box. Before that, it was a Buck Rogers planetary map.
Except I couldn't get those, said Frankie, because you needed to buy something else first. To get the baseball card, you had to buy a box of Wheaties, and for the planetary map, you needed a label from a can of cocoa malt. But for the harmonica, you don't need to get something else first. You can just order it, see?
Frankie, what's so important about this that you had to whistle for me? Frankie barely took a breath.
At the end of summer, there's going to be a big contest with prizes. The top winners get a spot in the band. And if a boy gets into the band, he's on easy street. The director, Hoxie, he pays for everything. Uniforms, new harmonicas, music lessons, you name it. They even have their own touring bus. And every summer, there's something called Camp Harmonica. All expenses paid.
He pointed to the paper.
Ain't they swell? I bet we could get into the band.
Mike read the caption under the photograph. Philadelphia Harmonica Band, led by Albert N. Hoxie, for boys ages 10 to 14. Frankie, you're only 7. Frankie pointed to a boy in the photo in the front row.
He looks younger than me.
Mike leaned closer. Frankie was right. The boy looked to be about 5. It lists him as a mascot performer. He's probably someone's little brother that plays decent and looks fine in a uniform.
You could try out. If you got in, maybe they'd let me be a mascot.
Mike shook his head. You think Pennyweather is going to let me audition for a band? And how do you plan to get anything delivered without her finding out? Plus, even if we got a harmonica, she isn't going to let us keep it. She took away our others first thing.
I already got that figured, said Frankie. Lowers do mail duty every day. We go in 2s to the letterbox at the end of the lane and then deliver the mail to her office. Someone will grab it from me and I'll hide it. You and me can take turns practicing when we're working in the fields where Pennyweather can't hear.
Frankie tapped the paper.
It says here, Hoxie even finds homes for kids who don't have families, if they're good enough for the band. See? We could run away and try out in August, before September gets here.
He stared at the paper, frowning. Mike felt a lump in his throat. He should have known Frankie would find out about Pennyweather's deadline. At Bishop's, news was like water passed in a bucket brigade.
So you heard about her getting rid of the lowers to make room for Hathaway boys, and me being put out to hire?
Frankie looked up at Mike, his eyes solemn, and nodded. Mike put an arm around him.
This band, That's good thinking, Frankie.
He leaned over the paper and read the mail-in form next to the photograph.
Honer Harmonica, the official instrument of the Harmonica Wizards. You too can learn to be a musician. Instruction booklet included.
He looked at Frankie.
I've only got about 30 cents. We'll have to wait till we save up.
Frankie handed the paper to Mike.
Can you keep this and my money for me? Eddie, two beds down, likes to steal.
He pulled a handful of pennies and nickels from his pocket.
Sure, I'll take good care of them.
Mike helped him up. When Frankie had one leg over the sill, he turned to Mike.
It was very, very important.
Mike nodded.
I know, kid. See you later.
He watched Frankie climb out the window and waited until he heard the whistle that meant he was safely down. Mike went back to his room and sat on the edge of his cot, studying the fine print on the order form for the harmonica.
Allow 4 to 6 weeks for delivery.
He covered his face with his hands, rubbing his forehead. By the time he and Frankie saved up the money, mailed away for the harmonica, and waited for it to arrive, it would be too late. Frankie would be in the state home. Mike pulled a slim metal box from a slit in the seam of his mattress. He had found it one day, left by some boy who'd slept in the cot before him. Luckily, it had escaped all of Pennyweather's surprise inspections, where she confiscated anything the boys tried to keep safe. He slipped the newspaper and the coins inside, buried it again, and sighed. Why couldn't he and Frankie catch a break? Mike's eyes drifted to Mouse's empty cot. Mouse was surely in New York City by now. Maybe Mike and Frankie should run away too. They could find McAllister at the train station and meet up with Mouse. If Mike was smart about it, he could get them far enough away from Bishop's before Pennyweather reported them. But how? And when?
Chapter 6. For the rest of the week, Mike fretted about their escape. 4 lowers had been fostered out within the last few days. Pennyweather was getting rid of the little lads like they were a grocer's special. 2 for the price of 1. How much time did Mike have? How far could they travel before Pennyweather became suspicious and reported them? What would happen if a truant officer caught up to them? The questions continued to weigh on Mike as he mopped the stairs on Friday afternoon. Mrs. Godfrey appeared below him in the entry.
"Michael, Mrs. Pennyweather wants you right quick in the dining hall. Your brother is already there."
Mike dropped the mop and clambered down the stairs. Out of breath, he arrived in the dining hall to find a man in overalls packing up tools and Pennyweather wiping down the piano with lemon oil. 3 chairs had been positioned nearby in a straight line. Frankie sat on the piano bench, swinging his legs. Pennyweather looked up.
"Michael, please join your brother."
He did, and Frankie leaned over and whispered,
"Pennyweather had the piano tuned. She wants us to play a song."
Mike sighed and tried to calm his racing heart.
"Is that all?"
Frankie nodded.
"That's what she said."
Frankie wasn't being fostered out? Mike couldn't decide if he was disappointed or relieved. The man closed his toolbox.
"All done, Mrs. Pennyweather. I fixed the pedals, too. She's got a beautiful sound, and you don't need to pay me. Anything for them orphan boys."
Pennyweather smiled.
"I am so grateful for your kindness."
When he was gone, she put her hands on her hips and faced Mike and Frankie.
"I have some men coming to look at the piano. They've asked if we have anyone here who is musical so they can determine the quality."
She shook her head.
"Don't know why they can't do that themselves. Regardless, you are the only ones who can play this noisemaker without pounding on it. The cooks told me you've been practicing some piece every night after dinner that makes them cry. Sentimental fools. So play that one, and make it sound just as good, or you'll both be back in the cellar."
She turned and began polishing the lid. Frankie tugged on Mike's sleeve and whispered,
"But Granny picked here 'cause of the piano."
Mike leaned his head toward Frankie's.
Shh. Better we keep Pennyweather happy.
Two men, wearing suits with vests, walked into the room. The taller, gray-haired man carried a briefcase.
Mrs. Pennyweather, I presume? I'm Mr. Golding, attorney at law, and this is my associate, Mr. Howard.
The younger man was the same height as Mike, fair-headed and freckled.
I'm also a family friend of the client. I've been given the authority to make a decision in this matter.
They both removed their hats.
Gentlemen,
said Pennyweather, nodding.
Pardon me, but I'm confused. Why do we need lawyers for this matter?
Mr. Golding frowned.
Certainly, if we come to an agreement, Mrs. Pennyweather, everything needs to be legal.
Pennyweather shrugged and looked puzzled.
Well then, let's get on with it. Here are Michael and Franklin Flannery, our best musicians, like you asked.
Wonderful, said Mr. Golding. We'd like to hear them play.
Of course, said Pennyweather, sweeping a hand toward the chairs. Please, sit down, gentlemen. Boys?
Mike and Frankie slid around and faced the keyboard.
America the Beautiful, whispered Mike. You come in after Amber Waves of Grain, just like I taught you. But at first, nice and slow, like a lullaby. Until almost the end. I know, said Frankie. Then like a storm, until the sea to shining sea part. And we make it all calm again.
He poised his hands. Ready. Mike began to play. After a few bars, he nodded to Frankie, who came in on cue. Mike couldn't believe this was the same piano. There were no sour notes, no avoiding a sharp, because it wasn't. The man was right. The piano had a beautiful tone. Mike filled up on the sound, as if he were eating something delicious, each bite better than the last. For a few moments, there was nothing but the music, no worries, no Pennyweather, just him and Frankie. Mike could almost believe that he was back in Granny's parlor, playing on a Sunday afternoon with the window open so everyone in the neighborhood could hear the music and have a little beauty in their lives. Mike used the damper pedal, and the chords filled the room. Before the last bars, he stopped playing altogether and let Frankie finish the song alone. Simple and sweet. Mike glanced around the room. At the far end of the hall, the cooks had stepped from the kitchen and were dabbing at their eyes. Uppers congregated at the windows and leaned on the sills. Lowers crowded the doorways, peeking in. Pennyweather furrowed her brow as if she didn't believe what she was hearing. Mr. Golding raised an eyebrow at Mr. Howard. After Frankie played the last note, there was a long breath of silence. Then the lads began to clap and whistle until Pennyweather stood, spun around, and waved everyone out. Mike and Frankie shifted around on the bench. Mr. Howard leaned forward.
Michael? How old are you?
11, sir.
How did you learn to play the piano?
His voice was soft and kind. He nodded to Frankie.
Our grandmother. She was a piano teacher.
Mike's the best player I know, said Frankie.
Mr. Howard smiled.
And how old are you, Franklin?
Everyone calls me Frankie. I'm 7, sir. Almost 8. I'm the second best player I know. But Mike's a progeny.
Mr. Howard smiled at his misuse of the word prodigy.
You're right, Frankie. He's very good. And so are you.
He looked at Mike.
You arranged that piece?
Yes, sir.
That was quite beautiful.
He cleared his throat.
How long have you two been here?
5 months and a few weeks, said Mike. We lived with Granny most of our lives, until we came here.
Granny picked here because it was the only orphanage with a piano, said Frankie. We gotta have a piano.
Pennyweather clapped her hands to interrupt.
Gentlemen, can we get back to business? Boys, you are dismissed.
Actually, I'd like them to stay, said Mr. Howard. Pennyweather pursed her lips.
I don't see any reason,
Mr. Golding interrupted.
Mrs. Pennyweather, our firm represents Eunice Dow Sturbridge. She is the daughter of Thomas Dow. Are you familiar with the name?
Who in Pennsylvania isn't?
Said Pennyweather.
Mr. Dow was a businessman. Tire company, wasn't it? I read in the newspaper he died last year.
Pennyweather crossed her arms.
What does he have to do with any of this?
Now that Mr. Dow has passed, his daughter is without any family, said Mr. Howard. She'd like to adopt a child. Mrs. Pennyweather's eyes darted from one man to the other.
I thought you were here to buy the piano.
Oh, heavens, no, said Mr. Golding. And I apologize if our intention was misleading. We asked if you had a piano and if there was a child here who was musical, who could play it for us, so we could determine the quality of the musician. You see, it must be a child who is musical.
Mr. Howard nodded.
Mrs. Sturbridge is a pianist of great talent, so you understand the desire for a child with the same inclination. We'd like to start adoption proceedings today.
Chapter 7
Mike's thoughts played leapfrog. They wanted to adopt a boy today? Mrs. Sturbridge was a rich woman. If she adopted Frankie, he'd have a home, he'd be safe, he'd have things. He'd probably go to a private school, and Mike would know where he was. This was Frankie's chance.
The papers have been readied in accordance, said Mr. Golding, reaching for his briefcase and opening it on his lap. And I can file them at the courthouse this afternoon. We're prepared to make a donation to the orphanage and give you a stipend for your personal attention to this matter.
A smile played on Pennyweather's lips.
I will gratefully accept. For the orphans.
She gestured toward Mike and Frankie.
Now, as to who to adopt, my recommendation is that you take Franklin. And don't worry about Michael. He'll be grateful for his brother's unusually good fortune.
She shot Mike a smile, but he knew it was meant as a warning.
I don't want to leave Mike, said Frankie.
Mike wrapped an arm around him.
I'd like to talk to the boys in private, said Mr. Howard.
Pennyweather stood.
I'm afraid that's not allowed.
Mr. Howard stood too, and Mr. Golding snapped his briefcase shut.
Then I suppose we'll be going to pay a visit at Hathaway House.
Wait! Don't be hasty, gentlemen. I can make an exception.
She stepped into her office and closed the door. As soon as she was gone, Frankie blurted,
They're not supposed to separate us.
Mike looked from Mr. Golding to Mr. Howard.
Sirs, if you mean to take only one of us, it should be Frankie. He's one of the youngest here. Mrs. Pennyweather plans to put me out to hire soon. I'm not old enough, but I guess I'm big enough. It's why she's not too keen on me leaving. But if I'm out working for months at a time, I won't be able to look out for Frankie, and he's still little.
No, Mike,
whimpered Frankie, his eyes tearing up.
We stick together, remember? And we're going to save our money for harmonicas and try up for Hoxie's band, and he'll find us a home, and...
Frankie cried harder. Mike dropped to one knee and pulled him close.
Don't throw a fit this time. Don't you see? If you go today, I'll know where to find you, and you won't end up in the state home.
He swallowed hard, looked at Mr. Golding, and blinked back his own tears.
Could I write and come visit him?
Of course, said Mr. Golding. I could even put a stipulation in the paperwork.
Frankie shook his head, sniffling.
No.
And I bet there's a piano.
Mike looked at Mr. Howard. He nodded.
There's a piano that sorely needs playing.
Mike stroked Frankie's back. He knew this was the right thing, but he couldn't stand looking in the kid's eyes and seeing the hurt.
I knew it. There's a piano. And I'll visit regular. It will all be okay. I promise.
Mike looked at Mr. Howard for reassurance. He turned away from Mike's gaze and walked to the window.
A moment later, he came back, blinking, his eyes bright. He cleared his throat and said to Mr. Golding, "It doesn't seem like a promising place, does it?"
"No," said Mr. Golding, "and it has a dreadful standing. But, hard as it is, Mr. Howard, time is of the essence. This is the fifth orphanage we visited in the last 2 weeks, and there's not been one child who came close to either of these boys. They're polite, endearing, and from what I've heard, extremely talented. If one of them will do, then let's take care of business."
Mr. Howard paced back and forth with his hands on his hips. The office door opened. Pennyweather came back into the room.
"Gentlemen?"
"We understand that Michael is to be put out for hire soon," said Mr. Howard.
"That's right," said Pennyweather.
"Making a child an indentured servant is against the law."
"It's called fostering now, Mr. Howard. If a business owner or farmer comes here to foster a child, it's none of my business what the child is expected to do to earn his keep. Call it what you like, indenturing, fostering, adopting. It's all the same to me."
Frankie looked up at Mike, tears streaming down his cheeks.
"I don't want to leave you."
Mike forced a smile.
"You'll be in a nice house. And when I visit, we'll play that piano together. I bet there's trees to climb, too, and a big yard, and good food. I bet they have Wheaties and cocoa malt. You'll go to school." "I don't care about Wheaties and cocoa malt. I want to stay with you,"
Frankie sobbed into Mike's arm. Mike's resolve crumbled. He knelt in front of Frankie and held him tight. Mr. Howard ran both hands through his hair. He walked to Mr. Golding and whispered in his ear.
"You're the representative in this matter," said Mr. Golding. "You've made up your mind?"
"I have," said Mr. Howard.
"Very well," said Mr. Golding. He turned to Pennyweather. "I'd like to speak with you in your office and draw up the papers."
"I think you'll be very happy with Franklin," said Pennyweather, smiling. "And let's discuss that donation for the unfortunate orphans and my small stipend."
Mr. Golding smiled back.
"Oh, Mrs. Pennyweather, I think you underestimate us. We don't do anything in a small way."
Chapter 8. Mr. Golding idled the black Ford sedan on Amaryllis Drive, where the homes kept their distance from the neighbors and the street. After they climbed out, Mr. Golding called,
"Good luck to you, Mr. Howard. I'm headed to the courthouse now. I'm glad I'm not the one to tell her."
He honked the car horn and pulled away. Frankie waved. Mr. Howard shook his head, smiling, and pushed open the wrought iron gate. At the end of a long walkway sat a caramel-colored house with white trim and red accents. An elevated porch with a wooden latticework skirt wrapped around two sides of the first level. A round two-story tower with a cone-shaped roof jutted from the left corner of the house and was topped with a weather vane. Steep gables pointed to the sky. Frankie stopped, open-mouthed, and stared.
"It's lovely, isn't it?"
said Mr. Howard, taking his hand.
"Queen Anne architecture. It needs some updating inside, but she's a beauty."
"How many people live here?"
asked Frankie. Mr. Howard laughed.
"Just one woman. And now you and Michael."
Mike's eyes swept across the wide lawns, the old elm in the side yard, and the manicured hedges.
"We're going to live here, Mike,"
said Frankie, grinning ear to ear. He let go of Mr. Howard's hand and skipped toward the house.
"We're being adopted, not fostered."
Mike wanted to feel Frankie's joy, but some tiny intuition told him it had all been too easy. In only a matter of hours, they'd been gathered up with their few belongings and brought here. Fostering was one thing, but adoption was another. It meant being part of a family. Forever. But no one ever adopted children without meeting them first. Granny always said if something seemed too good to be true, it was probably a swindle. At the market,
She had once showed him how the shiny waxed apples on top of the bushel often hid the bruised and rotten ones underneath. Was this house a shiny apple hiding something? A dark-skinned man knelt by a flower bed near the porch. As they approached, he set his trowel aside and stood, his height and sturdiness now apparent. Mr. Howard waved to him.
"Hello, Mr. Potter. This is Michael and Franklin, Mrs. Sturbridge's new wards."
Mr. Potter looked from one to the other, wiped his hands on his green apron, and nodded.
"Pleased to meet you."
Mr. Howard turned to Mike and Frankie.
"Mr. Potter is the groundskeeper and Mrs. Sturbridge's driver. He keeps the Packard up and running. He is also married to Mrs. Potter, the housekeeper. Mr. Potter, would you like to come inside for the introductions?"
Mr. Potter shook his head.
"I best get back to the geraniums. Seems safer. Mr. Howard, sir. You just stirred the pot real good."
He winked at the boys.
"What pot?"
asked Frankie. Mr. Howard smiled.
"He just means things will be different around here from now on."
Mike and Frankie followed Mr. Howard up the wide porch steps where he rang the bell.
"Here we go, boys."
A woman in a gray dress and white apron opened the door. A pleated maid's cap, like a crescent moon, perched on her head. Her brown skin was the same color as her sleeked back hair, which was knotted in a bun at the nape of her neck.
"Hello, Mrs. Potter," said Mr. Howard.
"Here we are. This is Michael, and this is Franklin. Boys, meet the woman who runs this house." Mrs. Potter raised her eyebrows at Mr. Howard.
"Before you say anything," said Mr. Howard, "yes, they are boys, and there are two of them. Where is she?"
"In the library, sir. And might I say you are a brave man?"
"I'm glad I'm not the one to tell her. Seems safer. Stirred the pot real good. Brave man." Why were they all talking in code? He and Frankie had been adopted. Wouldn't Mrs. Sturbridge be happy to see them? They followed Mr. Howard inside and stood in an entry hall the size of Granny's entire apartment. The floor was a checkerboard of black and white marble squares. A wide stairway with a dark wood banister hugged the left wall and curved toward the second story.
"Wow,"
whispered Frankie, craning his neck upward and pointing to the gilded chandelier dripping with three layers of giant teardrop crystals.
"She must have lots of money."
"Shh," said Mike, even though that was exactly what he was thinking. So this was how rich folks lived. Mike had never felt poor, but he'd never known any different either. When they'd lived with Granny, they'd had enough to eat and a safe place to sleep. And they had Granny, who loved them, so nothing else mattered. She used to say she never wanted for splendor, as long as she could have a piano and her two boys. If she could have seen all this, she would have said that none of it made one bit of difference unless the owner's heart was as beautiful as the house.
"Michael, Franklin, wait here."
Mr. Howard pointed to an upholstered bench. He walked through a set of double doors on the left and shut them partway behind him. Mrs. Potter headed down the hallway, shaking her head.
"There's a storm brewing, sure as I live."
Mike sat on the bench and watched Frankie walk halfway up the staircase.
"Boys!"
yelled a woman's voice from behind the doors.
"I send you for one girl, and you come back with two boys? How could you?"
Mike felt his stomach twist. He checked to see if Frankie heard, but he was too preoccupied with sliding his hand along the stair banister.
"You appointed me your representative, so I made the decision," said Mr. Howard.
"And it's the right one. The papers have been filed. They're brothers, and I couldn't bring myself to separate them. You'll understand that, I hope. And besides, two will be easier. They'll have each other. Now, come and meet them. They're in the hall." Her voice was shrill.
"What have you done?"
"Only what was required," said Mr. Howard. "Something you left until the final hour."
"I never thought it would come to this. I'm trying to get things changed."
I'm afraid you're out of time, said Mr. Howard. Mike heard something hit the wall, then glass breaking. Frankie darted from the stairs to Mike's side.
It's okay, Frankie, whispered Mike.
At least he hoped it was. She had wanted a girl, and Mr. Howard came back with them. If it had mattered so much, why hadn't she chosen a child herself? Something didn't feel right. Mike pulled Frankie in front of him and looked him square in the eyes.
We need to watch our every step, and remember our manners. We don't want to get her angry. Understand?
Before Frankie could answer, Mr. Howard stepped out of the library. He stood by the door, waiting. A woman appeared next to him, her mouth set in a grim line. Even though her face was red from anger or crying, Mike couldn't tell which. He could still see the brilliant yellow flecks in her hazel eyes. Her brown hair was a short bob of curls. Her black dress came past her knees. In her high-heeled shoes, she was as tall as Mike, but thin as a willow. A powdery vanilla scent surrounded her. The way Frankie gazed up at her, Mike could see he was smitten. Michael, Franklin, this is Eunice Dow Sturbridge, said Mr. Howard. Mike nodded.
Ma'am, thank you for adopting us,
Frankie blurted.
Are you going to be our new mother? You are much prettier than we expected, and you smell lots better than Mrs. Pennyweather.
Mrs. Sturbridge's eyes filled with tears as she looked them over and made a face as if she'd just seen a dead animal in the gutter. She turned and hurried up the stairs. At the top, she leaned over the railing and yelled,
"Get them to Mrs. Potter immediately!"
She disappeared down the hallway. A few seconds later, a door slammed so hard that the chandelier tinkled. "Believe it or not, boys," said Mr. Howard. "That went well." Chapter 9. A bar of soap floated on the steaming surface of the water in the claw-footed bathtub. Mrs. Potter stood in front of Mike and Frankie with her arms crossed, appraising their cleanliness. She did not seem pleased. Mike had seen that look before, in Granny's eyes every Saturday when they had to take a bath whether they needed it or not.
"After I leave, you'll get undressed and take turns in the tub and scrub from head to toe. Put the clothes in the basket. Tomorrow I'll wash the rest of your things."
"We don't have more clothes," said Frankie.
Mike looked at the floor, his face turning red.
"When we lived with our granny, we had more, and nicer."
"But they got lost at Bishop's," said Frankie.
"Then I'll be washing what you're wearing later tonight," said Mrs. Potter. "Thank goodness the missus has a newfangled clothing dryer for just this sort of emergency. They won't smell line fresh, but they'll be clean. I'll go ask Mr. Howard to bring over some nightshirts for you. They'll be hanging on the other side of the door when you're done."
"Does Mr. Howard live nearby?" asked Mike.
"He does. Lives at the end of the street. His father was Mr. Dow's lawyer, Mr. Dow being the missus's father. But I suppose you know that already. And now Mr. Howard is the same for the missus. But he's more family than lawyer. He's known her since she was knee-high."
Frankie began unbuttoning his shirt.
"Why do you call her the missus?"
"Mr. Potter and I have been here since the day she was born. We never called her anything other."
"Is she nice or mean?"
asked Frankie. Mrs. Potter handed them each a washcloth.
"Since Mr. Dow, bless his heart, died a year past, she's not been herself. But that's to be expected, considering all she's been through. Even so, I'd say she's a kind and loving soul, underneath all the rest."
"She didn't like the way we looked. Do you think she will like us once we're scrubbed clean?"
asked Frankie.
"That remains to be seen," said Mrs. Potter. "It appears there's lots of ifs and maybes to be sorted out."
Mike pulled Frankie closer and helped him unbutton his shirt. Ifs and maybes. If they were girls. If they didn't resemble something dragged from the street. If they weren't poor. Maybe she'd like them.
"Mrs. Potter, do you live here?"
asked Frankie. She nodded. "Mr. Potter and I live in the cottage to the side of the garden."
"Do you have any boys my age?"
asked Frankie. She laughed. "No. We have a grown daughter living and working in Atlantic City. Grew up right alongside the missus. She's a teacher now. We see her most